I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, my loves, and welcome to a very, very special episode of Steph and T. I don't know if you can believe it, but season one is in the books. We are wrapped with 16 episodes, 16 lives, 16 true stories that have made us laugh, cry, and clutch our tea mugs, and then occasionally scream, wait, what did they just say? This season has been an absolute ride. I mean, we've had tsunami survivors, Mormon escapees, FBI hostage negotiators, Moulin Rouge showgirls, child brides, face transplant miracles, gambling addicts, and heroin recoveries that are so shocking, I still can't believe them. So today, to honour all of my incredible guests, we are taking a walk down memory lane to celebrate the moments that shocked me, touched my heart, and honestly changed the way that I see the world. Guys, don't go anywhere, because at the end of this episode, I've got a little taste of what's to come in season two. And I mean, trust me, if you thought season one was wild, you've heard absolutely nothing yet. I can't believe I'm even saying that. Welcome to Steph and T, where every week I'm going to introduce you to the people behind jaw-dropping, life-altering, true stories from all over the world. I'm Stephanie Jones, TV host, storyteller, and your partner in crime for the wildest podcast ride you've ever been on. Each episode, you'll hear shocking stories that'll make you realize we humans are capable of anything. Now, let's spill the tea. So let's rewind back to the start, where we all began with sheer survival. One of our very first episodes with Riley, the tsunami survivor, and she described literally running for her life.
All the water has left. And it has left so quickly that fish are flying around everywhere. There's boats like on the sand. People who are snorkeling are now stuck on the reef. My mom had seen the water leave. She'd seen this whole thing happening and instantly knew what was happening. She starts yelling, run! And so I look back and there's my mom running towards us. And there behind her in the horizon is like this thin white line. And people are running in different directions. They're like banging into each other. It's chaos. Like no one knows what's going on. And then this thin white line is getting bigger and bigger and bigger by the second. And you then see it's an over 50 feet tsunami. So this huge wall of water is coming at our island at a rapid speed. And so my family, we like run to the other side of the island. And by this point, the wave is so close to us, like probably 300 feet from where we were. There was this one moment where I saw this man and he was like on his boat and the boat just hit him and hit. The boat consumed him. And there was this moment and I'm watching this man's life being taken away from him. I'm just thinking, we may not make it through today. Like our lives are hanging on by a thread. And I remember also looking behind me and seeing this mom who was like on a lounge chair, and next to her was a baby crying out, screaming. And this mom's just frozen in the like lounge chair and can't like just is frozen in fear. And I never saw that mom or baby again. This huge tsunami is getting closer and closer to us. The ground beneath us is shaking. People are screaming and shouting. And it's just sights and sounds like no one should ever see. And this is a force of a wave. It just obliterates anything in its path, building, person, anything.
I still get the chills whenever I hear her say that. I'm never going to forget it. It was a conversation that will stay with me for life. And then there was Joe, the man that survived a double hand and face transplant after a car crash and fire that went so wrong. And he is a living medical marvel. Now, his story is not just about science. It's about courage and hope and true love with his wife, Jessica. You found a matching donor. You're going into the surgery, and I'm sure there's a lot of scary thoughts. I mean, like, would you survive the surgery? Was that ever a conversation that you had?
My doctor, he said you can die in the surgery. That's the one thing I liked about him, was he was very straightforward and straight to the point. I can also die with just a simple, any other surgery I would have went through too. I felt really at ease with him.
Your surgery was groundbreaking. It was 23 hours involving 140 medical professionals. You're the first ever to have the face and the hands in the same surgery be successful at once.
Yeah, there's two before me. The first one passed away on the table. And the second one, the hands failed.
Right, okay. Well, you're a medical marvel. Was there anything that you thought, I never in a million years expected to either feel like this or to happen?
The feeling, yeah. There is the one test I did not like, and I will never do that ever again. The nerve test. That's when they stick needles in your face and hands and palms to see if the nerves and muscles are still working. When the needles are in you, they have to find the nerve that they want. They have to move the needle around. And then you have to flex your muscles, like, and then try and move your fingertips, which is hard for me because I was burned. And then the face part, they would stick the needle in your face, like all over, and then find the muscles. And then you have to talk. So my mouth would move in certain ways that they want. Mm. That was the worst thing I had to do for testing.
I'm guessing you weren't asleep, but did they give you any kind of pain relief, or is there no relief because it's in the nerves?
No, nothing. Stuck the needle in and just wow. Told me to talk and move. And that was it. I mean, it felt forever, but it was only an hour long. Especially the one part where they stuck the needle in and they turned like a little shocker on. It wasn't a bad shock, but you felt something and it felt worse because it was touching the muscle.
And then Grace. Oh my gosh, Grace. She looked me straight in the eye and told me that brain cancer was the best thing that's ever happened to her. You saying, which I don't think I've ever heard anyone say ever, you being diagnosed with a brain tumor is one of the best things that's ever happened to you.
Yeah.
Most people would be like, excuse me?
Yeah. Yeah, I think this concept was something that I've been talking about a lot recently. I realized as I started speaking about my story publicly, I was giving like TED Talks, and then I was on Capitol Hill, and then I was in like a grief group, and like no matter the audience, I realized the response was often the same. It would be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. That is so horrible. That's awful. And I realized that I was like nodding out of formality, but I didn't really agree with them anymore. Somewhere along those 10 years, and I'm not sure when, I had removed the traditionally perceived context of what it meant to have a brain tumor, which is, you know, that's so horrible, and replaced it with my own context, one that offered me joy and passion and community. And somewhere in that timeline, it changed from the worst thing that had happened to me to the best thing that had happened to me. And obviously, I acknowledge my privilege in being able to say that because a lot of my peers have passed away. And so I'm sure their parents would not agree that this is the best thing that has ever happened to them. And so I feel very lucky to have that feeling. But I also know that for the thousands of families that I've met, we all have a very similar perspective of, although we would never want anyone to be in our shoes, we feel oddly sort of grateful that we have gotten to be a part of this community. And I think that feeling is something that a lot of families in the fight grapple with, this weird back and forth. I'm extremely grateful for the things that it's taught me and the person it's made me. And I think I'm allowed to have that and then also mourn the life that I didn't get to live because it happened to me. So again, another back and forth, which I think is what we're learning, is this is just a very complicated thing.
Imagine turning something so dark into something with so much light and positivity. Talking with her really shifted the way that I look at life's challenges. And then we've had stories about breaking free and refinding yourself amidst the rubble and the mess of what you have left behind. I mean, of course, I'm never going to forget talking to Alyssa, the Mormon escapee, who told me she gave up what she believed to be eternal life for a coffee. I mean, is caffeine that good? And for those who don't know, tell us, really, why don't Mormons believe you can drink caffeine?
Yeah, so it's actually more complicated than that, because you can drink caffeine, but you can't drink coffee. So a lot of people think that the caffeine is what makes the coffee bad, but it's actually the fact that it's coffee that makes the coffee bad. So it's part of the Mormon health code called the Word of Wisdom, which also prohibits other things like tobacco and alcohol, but you also can't drink green tea or coffee, but you can drink Diet Coke, which doesn't really make sense. You know, if you really dig even an inch beneath the surface of the logic of this health code, it really doesn't make a lot of sense. Because you can't, you know, some people will say, can I have iced coffee? Because it's not a hot beverage, but that you can't sense. You can't have iced coffee. In my family, we couldn't have coffee cake. We didn't even call our coffee table a coffee table. We called it the living room table. So they can basically drink lots of sugary drinks, lots of caffeinated drinks, but as long as it doesn't include coffee, they're still following the rules.
Okay. What was it like the first time you did actually drink a latte or a cappuccino or something, seeing as it was so forbidden?
It's kind of anticlimactic, because you're taught that it's so evil. And there was a speech given once where this woman was kind of kept out of Mormon heaven because she drank coffee. And so when I tried it for the first time, you know, you sip it and I feel like I was almost expecting, if you've seen a movie where someone like does drugs and they just go insane, I felt like maybe the first time I tried coffee, I would just start ripping things off the wall and flipping tables or something in a caffeinated rage. But it was very underwhelming. It was very nice. It was just a nice little sip of a tasty beverage in a quiet and calm coffee shop. And I was like, well, this is not the evil I was expecting from this experience.
And then the baptizing the dead thing, I was literally like, wait, excuse, what? They do what? You mentioned it was a bit of a culty experience for you, and things that you just were really uncomfortable doing or just didn't like it. You guys did baptisms, but for the dead. So what is going on there?
When you hear baptisms for the dead, you picture someone exhuming a body from a graveyard. So it's not that.
Yeah, literally.
It's not that awful. According to Mormon belief, everyone has to be baptized as a Mormon in order to go to the highest level of Mormon heaven. But obviously less than 1% of the Earth's population is Mormon. And so that means that they do baptisms by proxy for those who have passed on. So say you get baptized in the church. Here you are, alive and well. You want your great-great-grandma to be able to receive the blessings of Mormonism, and you know she won't be able to get into Mormon heaven without it. And so you take her name, you go to the temple, and they literally baptize you, and they say, this baptism is for and in behalf of your great-great-grandma, you know, Denise or whatever. And then and you would be baptized. So the goal is to literally baptize everyone who's ever existed on the planet, which does come, like, you know, they got in big trouble with Judaism in general, because it was discovered they were baptizing people who had passed away in the Holocaust or who had died in the Holocaust. And so they baptized Anne Frank, for example. You know, how obviously for that faith, they view it as very disrespectful that Mormons are going to all of these records from the Holocaust and using the records from the Holocaust to be able to figure out who needs to be baptized to be Mormon in the afterlife. And I think the Catholic Church now has a rule that they're not giving the Mormon Church any of their documents, because they realized, you know, the church would come along and say, we love genealogy. We want to learn all about, you know, grandparents and great-grandparents and who was immigrating from Europe. And it sounds great, you know, to just do genealogy work. But when when these religions realized what they were using the names to do, they said they're not going to give this information over to the church anymore because they're objecting to what they're using it for.
So what do the Mormons believe happens when you die to, I guess, justify doing things like the baptisms for the dead, or like, what is their idea of heaven? Like you say, the 1%, what does that look like for that 1%?
So the Mormon afterlife requires a flowchart in order to understand it. So if anyone's listening, I suggest Googling Mormon plan of salvation, and that will show you the flowchart. That's what I used to show people on my mission. But basically, after we die, our body goes in the ground and our spirit or soul goes to what's called the spirit world. And if you were Mormon, you get to go to spirit paradise. And if you weren't Mormon, you go to spirit prison. And the only way you can cross from prison to paradise is if someone gets baptized for you for the dead in this life. So in that situation where your grandma Denise is, you're getting baptized for her, she would have been kept in spirit prison no matter how good of a person she was, no matter how, you know, if even if she was a Christian, all of the non-Mormons get sent to spirit prison. And then someone would go, you know, knock on her door and say, hey, your great-great-granddaughter just got baptized for you. You're good to go to paradise. And if she chose to accept the baptism, she would cross over into spirit paradise.
She blew my mind with her bravery, and that episode had us all completely shook.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you, and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
And then, oh, we cannot forget Salima, the child bride. That conversation broke me. She talked about being assaulted and left behind by her own parents in Bangladesh.
My mum, she started to like amp up her manipulation a bit more. She basically said to me, okay, if you agree to get engaged to him, then you can go home. So I thought, okay, if I get engaged to him and then I can go home, that means technically I'm not married. But what I didn't know was in Bangladesh, the engagement is actually like an Islamic marriage. What she actually meant by engagement was get religiously married to him. So the day of the engagement came, long story short, it was an Islamic marriage ceremony, not an engagement party. The guy, the imam came in and he was saying something to me. I don't know what he was saying. He was like reading something from a religious text. And then the women around me were like, say this word three times. So I kind of said it, not realizing that I'm getting married. So after the party finished, my mom had a pre-packed suitcase ready for me. They put me and him in a lift together. And my mom gave me the suitcase and said, oh, like, there's everything you'll need in there. I was really confused. I was saying, where am I going? They were like, oh, you have to stay with him. Like, I said that I didn't want to stay with him. That's when they told me, well, you're married to him, so you have to go and stay with him. This is like your honeymoon.
And then really, you're now married and you're finding out in that moment, like, given a suitcase, like, that's it, that's your husband, goodbye, basically.
Pretty much, yeah. You have to go and stay with him now. And I said, I don't want to stay with him. But, yeah, I had to go anyway. So I was staying in a hotel with this guy for 2 days. He raped me. that night. So, and for the remaining weeks that I had to live with him, it was just constant. But yeah, that night we got to the hotel, he forced himself on me, and I don't remember what happened, but I think my body had kind of just shut down by then. So after the rape happened, I had like an excruciating pain in my abdomen. It's the worst pain I've ever had. I don't think I've ever had pain like that kind of ever since or before. But I had the most kind of excruciating pain in my abdomen. Even he kind of got worried about me because it was that bad. And they gave me some medication and I woke up like 14 hours later. My body just shut down and wasn't really able to cope with kind of everything that had happened. I woke up after we left the hotel. I had to go and live with him and his family. And my siblings and my parents had left his house now. So now they'd left me there with his family by myself.
That story will forever sit heavy in my heart. And it completely breaks it that the people that were meant to look after the most in this world were the ones that betrayed her. Then there was the brutally honest and inspiring gambling addict, Patrick. His story, the rush, the spiral, the way his addiction nearly cost him his life, it was eye-opening, and that's something that could truly save other people's lives.
People talk about a double life. It was literally a double life. What people saw was completely different to what was going on in my head and also when nobody was looking.
Did you ever worry, what if someone catches on, or if I'm up all night, not sleeping, like someone's going to notice?
Yeah, I think I did. I lived in constant fear about being found out. And I think that made me even better at hiding it. And to a degree, kind of protecting the addiction. So I kind of went to greater lengths as time went on to make sure that I didn't. It started to take its toll in other ways. It became more exhausting. I was a master of disguise, so there was that. There was the fact that if I got found out, what would the consequences be? And of course, how would I continue to be able to gamble and doing these things? And I now realise and understand that for a long time, I didn't want to stop. I wasn't ready to stop. And so I would do everything I could to make sure that I would be able to gamble. My priority was to never be found out. And of course I realise now I was always going to get found out. Time went on, my debts just started to get bigger and bigger, and it felt like time was kind of running out, and everything was going to catch up with me. And I was constantly saying to myself that all I needed to do was get to a point where I could pay everybody back and the problem would go away. And that was only accelerated when essentially it got to the point where I knew I was on the verge of getting found out, and I was gonna I knew I was gonna lose the house that I lived in, I knew I was gonna lose my job, and only I knew I might face sort of quite serious criminal convictions as a result of what I'd been doing. And at that point I panicked, of course, and I got to the point where I had over £50,000 across 19 different betting accounts. I put it all on one bet, one horse. It was at that point that I sort of said to myself, look, if this horse wins, then I will win all that money back. My intention was to kind of pay off all my debts and life would go on. And if it didn't, then I had reached a point where I thought I can't go on, and I was going to go and do the unthinkable and end my life. And that's where gambling had literally beaten me.
And of course, we ended with Angie, the heroin addict. 17 years of her life given to addiction. And the fact that she admitted to us about robbing her own father on his deathbed and her brother, I mean, that moment left me speechless.
When I made the decision to steal from him while he was dying in the hospital, because that was a very, actually, that trumps it all now that I think about it, because that was something that I literally never, ever, ever thought that it, because he was the only support that I had. I would steal from stores. I would steal from big corporations, people who could afford it, right? That's kind of what made me feel better. I would never steal from people, and especially not my parents, right? I honestly never did until that time. And it took me a long time to even say it out loud. I couldn't even like verbalize the fact that I did that because I was so ashamed of myself for that. So I think actually now that I think about it, that takes the cake.
Or what was it that you stole?
Money. He had been paying my rent, but I lied to myself and told myself that I needed the money to pay that. Well, I did need the money to pay rent, but the money didn't go to rent. I justified it in my own brain. Like, well, he was going to give it to me anyways. Right. That was awful because I was at the bank and the cops pulled up and the cop was on the phone and handed me the phone and it was my dad. And he was like, he swore. He was like, and you effed up. And they arrested me, took me to the police station.
Her honesty and her journey from darkness to hope truly is one of the bravest transformations that I have ever witnessed. Then there were the episodes that just cracked me wide open. Sabrina, the widow. Oh, in the grief episode, she touched my soul and I found myself just crying. My eyes were pouring out right alongside her as she told me all about the loss of her husband, Tony. I just feel terrible.
No,
I
my gosh. No.
Please don't feel bad.
That's okay. Oh, we cry together. Oh. That's just part of grieving.
Oh. Mm-hmm. I saw you sharing such an intimate and beautiful part of your life that touched my soul. It really did. And my heart just went out to you so much for what you were going through and how brave you'd been. And I thought it was so beautiful that you'd saved that last meal for the moment where you were leaving your home with Tony to start a new chapter of your life, a very exciting new chapter of your life. But by doing that, you almost also time capsule it again to something you can watch back, you can relive and remember the emotions, the feelings. I really think that's really beautiful.
Ooh, I think, honestly, I was so exhausted at that point because I had been packing all week and selling furniture and just going through, you know, moving anywhere is really, really stressful. And I had a lot of moments where I was definitely frustrated and really sad that Tony was not there with me physically. I'm just so in shock by how sharing a moment of vulnerability can open those kind of opportunities. It's just like, it's not something you really think about when you go through that, but it really is so nice that I was able to connect with so many people through that. My first time grieving someone so, so close to me, I really had no idea like what to even think, like how to even move forward. So all I could think of in that moment was, I need to have an outlet where I share very openly about this. I just kind of was like, okay, I'm going to just put it out into the internet then and put it out into the universe. And even if it's in the form of a sad video, like whatever helps me, I'm going to just do.
What would you say to someone who's listening that has newly lost someone or is grieving someone that they love? What would you wish that someone had told you?
I would first and foremost say that I'm so sorry that life is really cruel in so many ways. And I'm sorry that life had to take away someone who was so special to you. And a lot of these things will never, ever make sense to us. And I'm just sorry that you're going through that and having to deal with something you probably never expected to go through. And you really are not alone. And there really isn't anything that I can truly say to alleviate the weight of that grief and to make that pain any less. You have to do what you have to do to survive. And I do really believe that one day that grief will slowly evolve into deeper and deeper love. Grief does evolve.
there really is so much love behind it all.
She reminded us all that grief is simply love with nowhere to go. And then, of course, we had my girl, Brittany. Oh my gosh, so empowering with her fertility story. She reminds every single woman that's listening to this that you can do anything. Your story is fascinating. Your solo trips, your egg freezing, like the whole what's expected of a woman timeline kind of rebellion. Did you ever think that all of this would become your legacy?
Funny, I asked my mom and my therapist that all the time. I'm always like, did you think that I would be living such a different life? I was in a very American sorority. Out of 30 women that were in my pledge class, I think like 28, 29 are married. Like, I am such an outlier, you know? Yeah, I think I always had this little voice that I was like, I think I wanna experience it all. I wanna have heartbreak. I wanna have love. I wanna live in different cities. And so it was like in me that I just wanted to go live this big life. But I didn't think I would go so far in such a different direction, you know? But life just happened that way. Like, I was fired. I hated jobs. Like, I had so many crazy career issues. I remember even being like 32 or 33 and like I have this like blog post where I was just like crying and feeling so lost. I have no purpose. I'm never going to make money. What am I going to do in my life kind of thing. I remember I had this job that I got fired from. It was like an email software tool company. It was so boring. Like the CEO and founder knew I just was like dying inside every day. And I remember him asking me, do you want to be a CMO? You know, you don't really have a lot of like grit or drive. And I was like, no, I do not want to climb the ranks of marketing or the corporate world. And he's like, well, what are you going to do? And I was like, I don't know. And I remember him having this whole conversation about hustle and how I was lacking hustle. And for years, I believed that story thinking I don't have hustle. I'm just not a hustler. I don't have drive. I'm not hardworking. And then in this role, it opened up. And I'm one of the biggest hustlers I know. I mean, last year, I think I was a workaholic. I think the whole story of why I'm saying this is like, when you find the right thing, your insecurities go away and you can really thrive. And I feel like having my own business and having something that as much work I put in, I get output is such a beautiful feeling. You do evolve as you get older and you can't doubt yourself because things will evolve how they should.
Whether it's motherhood, life, holidays, the career of your dreams, you can curate the life you want all by yourself. And of course, that also then relates to Charlie Craggs, the absolute queen. She reminds us all to love ourselves more. And she even admitted that she doesn't give herself enough credit.
I give transitioning a go, and then if I can't hack it, then I'll kill myself. That's literally how dark it is. So like, if people understood that, I think they'd give us a bit more compassion and a bit more kindness, even if they don't really like agree with us for whatever reasons. Why would anyone choose this fucking shit life of like, I can't even go to the corner shop without people like hearing my voice, my big, horrible, manly voice that I don't want, and like looking at me and laughing? Like, do you know how embarrassing that is? Like, I could cry now. Like, it makes me so angry. Like, it just ruins my life. Like, why would I want this? I could have lived a lovely life as like a gay man, a normal gay man. I'm white as well. I could have been a white man. Do you know, like, why would I fucking give that up to be some bottom of the barrel, like bottom of society, like trans woman who like literally can't go out of her house without being laughed at? What? Who would?
You're not the bottom of the barrel. Don't say that.
I'm shaped like a barrel as well, Stephanie. That's really hard. I'm a fat trans woman, so it's even worse. But point being, it's like, it's really like hard. No one would in their right mind be like, oh yeah, I could do it. No, you would be so embarrassed if you had to go out as like a trans person. Like, this is literally like, we're not choosing this. We wouldn't want this.
So Charlie, I've just got to say, throughout all of this, I feel like, I don't know if you're not intentionally doing it, but you like put yourself down so much. And you're like, oh, my voice. And it just like hurts my heart, honestly.
So sweet, Steph. I think it's like when like the world has treated you a certain way, you become like a bit Like, you're so shaped and conditioned by what you've been through.
I just think, you know, people just need to be so much kinder. And you also, you need to be kinder to you.
I agree.
You really do. I mean, listening to her, she's so brave and the voice for so many. And sometimes it's important to remember to empower yourself too. One episode that hit me personally was Ursuline leaving her home, LA, for love. She's chasing her heart and her dreams all the way to Paris.
I'm dating everywhere, dating in LA. Nothing's been successful. I'm dating within my church, dating with friends who set me up, paying for matchmakers, and none of that is working. I had to make something different, and so I was leaving the country to search for love.
I love that you're so proactive in like listening to yourself, your needs, your wants and goals, and acting on it. I'm from England, originally, right? I wanted to experience another country. A lot of people think you're absolutely bonkers. And they will say, you know, like, what, why? But sometimes you've got to just take a leap of faith and you know internally, like, this is what I want to do. And you only have one life. You've got to live,
yeah,
right?
It's so true. I will put out there that I am a person who has always been very adventurous. And I am not risk averse. I usually take bets on myself, but they're not bets that are like on the whims of like hopes and dreams. Like usually I'm going off of things that I know I really can bank on, right? My body was vibrating that I had to be in Paris. I think I needed to just have gone into it head first, just knowing that something had to have come out of this better than what I was experiencing dating in Los Angeles. Because I love LA, but it wasn't giving me what I needed. Do you know the meme where it has Jesus and the girls in the front and Jesus has his hand out and she has a little bear in her hand and he has a huge bear behind him? That's what I was thinking. There are so many bigger things that can come out of this.
Her story reminded me that sometimes the bravest thing we can do is just go for it. Live your dreams. If you've got a calling, get out there and do it. And I'm telling you, her Prince Charming is just waiting in the wings. And then, of course, we had our pure game-changing, life-altering advice and the we will never forget these moments to include, obviously, Scott Harvey, the former FBI-trained hostage negotiator that taught us all about keeping our calm in the most tense of environments when everything is hanging in the balance, literally on the line, and how to manage our emotional teeter-totters. When you're learning to deal with very extreme psychological pressure, when you're actually in that situation, how do you deal with that when you're like, this is someone's life literally on the line? They could hurt themselves. They could hurt somebody else.
I think one of the things we get a bad rap for in law enforcement, and I understand why, is people say, well, they turn off their emotions. They disconnect emotionally from the world. And there is some truth to that. We have to do that because the most valuable thing I ever learned as a negotiator is in everybody's brain is a teeter-totter. And on one end of that teeter-totter is emotion. I don't care what that emotion is, fear, anger, frustration, joy, whatever. On the other end of that teeter-totter is logic and reason. So when emotions go up, logic and reason go down. So as a negotiator, I'm dealing with somebody who's highly emotional, which means they're not physiologically capable of processing logic and reason at that time. This is why when you've come home or your spouse has come home from a hard day, and let's say your spouse starts venting and you spit out a very logical solution to their problem and they blow right past it like they didn't even hear it because they are not able to process it. Now, 2 hours later, if they've vented, if they've gotten it out and spent some time thinking about it, when logic and reason come back up, they might come to you with that solution because now they're able to process it. Their subconscious mind caught it, but they couldn't process it at the time. So as a negotiator, knowing every person I dealt with was imbalanced on the emotion side, which meant I needed to keep my emotions in check. I needed to be the calm. The louder somebody yelled at me as a police officer, the quieter I talked back to them. Now, not to be patronizing, because that can be insulting, but just because I need to start de-escalating this. because while they're emotional, they're not thinking clearly. And I need them to think clearly. So sometimes as a negotiator, that meant when I made contact with them every time, they yelled at me, they cussed me out, they threatened me, they threatened my family, and then they would hang up. And I'd call them right back. And they'd yell at me and cuss me out and because as they're yelling, that emotion is starting to come down. And I need that emotion to come down. In the real world, what we tend to do when somebody hits us with high emotion, with an imbalanced teeter-totter, is we get emotional. And we're like, well, they don't know who they're talking. I don't need to listen to this crap. And we just start getting emotional ourselves, and neither person calms down. It just ratchets up and ratchets up until it's way out of control. So what I would tell people is the more loud somebody is, the quieter you have to be. Now, the problem in law enforcement today, Stephanie, in my opinion, is we spend a lot of time with logic and reason really high and emotion really low. We try to take emotion out of it because that's a good way to stay alive. We have to make split-second decisions that have lifelong ramifications, and we don't have time for emotion.
That's advice I definitely needed to take for myself. And of course, we had the gorgeous Rosie, the pageant queen who found herself up against a near kidnapping experience in Manila. Literally, Miss Congeniality meets Narcos. I mean, it was just wild. Then teaching us all to never judge a book by its cover was the lovely Sydney, the breakout star of Netflix's Million Dollar Secret. She gave us the drama, the sass, the secrets, and it was giving reality TV energy in all the best ways. Sydney, from a small town in Alaska where there is literally a few hundred people, to now being on the world's biggest platform, Netflix. What made you apply then to go on Million Dollar Secret?
I was approached basically by a casting director, and they were like, we really love your look. Like, we have this TV series, Temptation Island, and it wasn't the right show for me. One of the casting producers started advertising for Million Dollar Secret. And I was like, $1 million, cool challenges, physically active, mentally stimulated. So I applied. Next thing I knew, I got a call back. And then I started going through the interview process. And they finally said, you're in, you're a finalist. It's a once in a lifetime opportunity. The next thing I knew, I was being flown to Kelowna in this beautiful chateau that was lakeside with the best staff and the most incredible food I've ever had. And, you know, you hand your phone over, and that was fantastic. Not having my phone for a little over 3 weeks, complete mental detox. Yeah.
Did you go in there thinking, you know what? I've got a real shot of winning this. Like, this is mine.
I don't do anything unless I think I'm going to win.
I mean, she deserves it all, and she's going to go all the way. Mark my words. Then there's Allie, the Canadian Moulin Rouge showgirl that spilled all the Parisian backstage secrets. And I mean, if you guys don't want to book a ticket to Paris and go see her strut her stuff under the bright stage lights after hearing her story, you are simply lying. There's no way. So yeah, season one, it wasn't just a podcast. It's been an emotional roller coaster. It's been shocking, inspiring. It has been heartbreaking. But more than all of that, for all of my guests, it was simply real. These are stories that touched me, and honestly, they changed me and how I see the world. And judging by your messages and reviews, they've struck a chord with a lot of you guys too. Season one has been incredible. And yes, like all good things, it has come to an end. But the best bit? We are just getting started. Season two is already well on the way. And we've been talking to Olympic athletes, Russian spies, love and dating experts, and we've got even more shocking survival stories, more jaw-dropping moments, and even more tea to spill. I can't believe I'm saying this, but if you thought season one was wild, trust me, you haven't heard anything yet. And yes, that is a bold statement. Guys, thank you. Thank you for listening, for sharing these episodes and being part of such an incredible journey with me. And that's it for me. For now, season one has been signed, sealed, and spilled. Now, obviously, I'm not going to leave you completely in the lurch. You guys can go back, re-listen to your favorite episodes, send ones to a friend who might just need a little bit of inspiration, and get yourselves ready because season two is about to get even hotter. Until then, make sure you follow, subscribe so you do not miss the season two launch. Guys, keep dreaming, keep living boldly, and thank you not only for listening, but to my guests for spilling the tea with me. You've all been incredible. See you next time.